was of Italy. Let Troy's ill luck, that has dogged us so far, follow no further. Ye too, gods and goddesses all, who could not bear Ilium, and the great fame of the Dardans, it is proper now for you to spare the Trojans. And, O most holy Sibyl, foreseer of future things, grant, I but ask for the kingdom owed by my destiny, grant that we Trojans may settle in Latium, we and our wandering gods, the hard-driven deities of Troy. Then will I found a temple of solid marble to Phoebus and Trivia, appointing festival days in Phoebus' honour. You too shall have your holy place in the realm to be, where I shall deposit the oracles, the mystic runes you utter for my own people, ordaining a priesthood to their service, O gracious one. But do not commit your sayings to leaves, lest they become the sport of whisking winds and are scattered. Speak them aloud, I pray. Aeneas made an end now. But the Sibyl, not yet submissive to Phoebus, there in her cavern prodigiously struggled, still trying to shake from her brain the powerful god who rode her. But all the more he exhausted her foaming mouth and mastered her wild heart, breaking her in with a firm hand. And now the 100 immense doors of the place flew open of their own accord, letting out the Sibyl's inspired responses. O you that at last have done with the dangers of the deep, yet graver ones await you on land, the Trojans shall come to power in Lavinium. Be troubled no more about this, but shall not also be glad that they did. Wars, dreadful wars I see, and Tiber foaming with torrents of human blood. You will not escape a Simois, a Xanthus there, a Greek encampment. Latium has a new Achilles in store for you, he too a goddess' son. Nor yet shall the Trojans anywhere be rid of Juno's vendetta. Ah, then, in your extremity, what tribes, what townships of Italy shall you not sue for aid? Once more, it's an alien bride, a foreign marriage that's destined to cause such terrible harm to the Trojans. But never give way to those evils. Face them all the more boldly, using what methods your luck allows you. The way of salvation begins where you'd least expect it, stems from a Greek city. Thus from her sanctum spoke the Cumaean Sibyl, pronouncing riddles that awed them. Her voice came booming out of the cavern, wrapping truth in enigma. She was possessed. Apollo controlled her, shaking the reins and twisting the goad in her bosom. As soon as her ecstasy ebbed and her raving mouth was silent, the hero Aeneas began to speak. Maiden, there's nothing new or unexpected to me in such trials you prophesy. All of them I have forecast, worked out in my mind already. I have one request, since here is reputed to be the gateway of the underworld and the dusky marsh from Acheron's overflow. May it befall me to go into my dear father's presence. Open the hallowed gates and show me the way. Him through the flames, through a thousand pursuing missiles, I rescued out of the enemy's midst and bore him away on these shoulders. He voyaged with me, enduring sea after sea, enduring all menace of sea and storm, weak as he was. Great ordeals beyond his strength, exceeding the normal lot of old age. Yes, and he himself most earnestly bade me, more than once, to come to you here and make this appeal. I pray you, kind one, take pity on father and son. You have the power. It was not for nothing that Hecate put you in charge of the grove of Avernus. Orpheus, with only the tuneful strings of a Thracian lyre to aid him, could conjure forth the ghost of his wife. Pollux, who, turnabout, shares life and death with his mortal brother, constantly comes and goes this way. I need not mention Theseus or Hercules. I, too, am descended from great Jove. Thus he was making petition, his hands upon the altar, when the Sibyl began to speak. O child of a goddess' womb, Trojan son of Achaeus, the way to Avernus is easy. Night and day lie open the gates of death's dark kingdom, but to retrace your steps, to find the way back to daylight, that is the task, the hard thing. A few, because of Jove's just love, or exalted to heaven by their own flame of goodness, men born from gods, have done it. Between there lies a forest, and darkly winds the river Cocytus round the place. But if so great your love is, so great your passion to cross the Stygian waters twice, and twice behold black Tartarus, if your heart is set on this fantastic project, here's what you must do first. Concealed in a tree's thick shade, there is a golden bough. Gold the leaves and the tough stem, held sacred to Proserpine. The whole wood hides this bough, and a dell walls it round as it were in a vault of shadow. Yet none is allowed to enter the land which earth conceals, save and until he has plucked that gold-foil bough from the tree. Fair Proserpine ordains that it should be brought to her as tribute. When a bough is torn away, another gold one grows in its place with leaves of the same metal. So, keep your eyes roving above you, and when you have found the bough, just pull it out. That branch will come away quite easily, if destiny means you to go. Otherwise, no amount of brute force will get it, nor hard steel avail to hew it away. Also, and this you know not, the lifeless corpse of a friend is lying unburied, a dead thing polluting your whole expedition while you are lingering here to inquire about fate's decrees. Before anything else, you must give it proper burial and make sacrifice of black sheep. Only when you are thus purified shall you see the Stygian groves and the regions untreadable to the living. She spoke, then closed her lips. Aeneas, eyes downcast, countenance full of sorrow, moved off, leaving the cave, pondering much in his heart on the cryptic issues the Sibyl had raised. Loyal Achates walked with him, his gait heavy beneath the same load of trouble. Many were the conjectures they threw out, one to the other, as to which of their dead friends the Sibyl had meant, and whose body must be interred. Now, when they drew near the beach, they saw there the body of Maecenas, cut off by cruel death. Maecenas, son of Aeolus, whom none had excelled in firing the warrior passions of men with thrilling trumpet calls. He had been a comrade of mighty Hector, at Hector's side had fought, and won great fame as a trumpeter and a spearman. After Achilles had defeated Hector and killed him, this valiant hero, Maecenas, attached himself to Dardan Aeneas' company, following now no lesser a man. But today, as he sent his horn's notes ringing over the sea, most rashly challenging the gods to a musical contest, jealous Triton caught him off guard, if we may credit the story, and plunged him down in the surf among those rocks. Now they were all standing around him, lamenting loudly, not least the good-hearted Aeneas. And now at once they hasten, weeping, to carry out the Sibyl's instructions, piling timber up with a will for a towering funeral altar. Into the age-old forest, where only wild things lurk, they go. Spruces are felled, the home oak rings with axe blows. Wedges are used to split ash logs and the cleavable wood of oaks. Immense rowans are rolled down from the heights. Aeneas himself, in the middle of these activities, carrying the same tools as they, encouraged his friends. But also, sad at heart, gazing up at the huge forest, he brooded, and then he uttered his thoughts aloud in a prayer. If only I might glimpse that golden bough on its tree in the great wood this very moment. For all that the Sibyl said about you, Maecenas, was true, too sadly true. The words were hardly out when it befell that two doves came planing down from above before his very eyes, and alighted upon the green turf. The hero recognized his mother's birds. His heart leapt up, and he said a prayer. "Show me the way, if way there is. Oh, wing your flight to that part of the forest where the precious bough overshadows the fruitful soil. Do not forsake me, Heavenly Mother, at this most crucial hour." He spoke, stopped in his tracks to note what signs they gave and in what direction they'd move. Now the doves, as they fed, flitted on from spot to spot, but never so far ahead that one who followed lost sight of them. Then, when they came to the mouth of foul-breathing Avernus, swiftly they soared, went gliding through the soft air and settled, the pair of them, on a tree, the wished-for place, a tree amid whose branches there gleamed a bright haze, a different colour, gold. Just as in depth of winter the mistletoe blooms in the woods with its strange leafage, a parasite on the tree, hanging its yellow-green berries about the smooth round boles, so looked the bough of gold leaves upon that ilex dark, and in a gentle breeze the gold foil foliage rustled. Aeneas at once took hold of the bough, and eagerly breaking it off with one pull, he bore it into the shrine of the Sibyl. Meantime, upon the shore, the Trojans were still lamenting Misenus, and paying the last rites to his oblivious dust. First they laid resinous wood, and upon it sections of oak trees to build the pyre up high. The sides of the pyre were wattled with sombre-foliaged boughs. In front they planted funereal cypresses, and his shining arms adorned its top. Some lit fires beneath the cauldrons and boiled water. They washed and anointed the corpse of their friend, so cold in death. All were lamenting. When they had wept him, they laid on the bier his body, covering it with purple drapes and the dead man's own clothing. The bearers lifted the bier onto the pyre, a melancholy office, and in the traditional manner, averting their eyes, applied the lighted torches. The pile of offerings burned, the incense, the meat, the libations of oil. Now, when the ashes had fallen in and the flames died down, they quenched the remains, the thirsty embers, with wine. And collecting the bones, Corineus put them away in a casket of bronze. He then moved round his comrades three times, bearing pure water. Aspersing them with drops he shook from a branch of fruitful olive, he purified them and spoke the farewell words. Aeneas the True now raised over his friend a massive tomb, laying on it the man's own arms, his oar, and his trumpet, beneath that high headland which takes its name from him, Misenum, and preserves his fame unto all ages. This done, Aeneas hastened to follow the Sibyl's directions. A deep, deep cave there was, its mouth enormously gaping, shingly, protected by the dark lake and the forest gloom. Above it, no winged creatures could ever wing their way with impunity. So lethal was the miasma which went fuming up from its black throat to the vault of heaven. Wherefore the Greeks called it Avernus, the birdless place. Here the Sibyl first lined up four black-skinned bullocks, poured a libation of wine upon their foreheads, and then, plucking the topmost hairs from between their brows, she placed these on the altar fires as an initial offering, calling aloud upon Hecate, powerful in heaven and hell. While other laid their knives to these victims' throats, and caught the fresh warm blood in bowls, Aeneas sacrificed a black-fleeced lamb to Night, the mother of the Furies, and her great sister Earth, and a barren heifer to Proserpine. Then he set up altars by night to the god of the underworld, laying upon the flames whole carcasses of bulls, and pouring out rich oil over the burning entrails. But listen, at the very first crack of dawn, the ground underfoot began to mutter, the woody ridges to quake, and a baying of hounds was heard through the half-light. The goddess was coming, Hecate. The Sibyl cried, "Away! Now stand away, you uninitiated ones, and clear the whole grove. But you, Aeneas, draw your sword from the scabbard and fare forth. Now you need all your courage, your steadfastness of heart." So much she said, and, ecstatic, plunged into the opened cave mouth. Unshrinking went Aeneas step for step with his guide. "You gods who rule the kingdom of souls, you soundless shades, Chaos and Phlegethon, O mute wide leagues of Nightland, grant me to tell what I have heard. With your assent may I reveal what lies deep in the gloom of the underworld." Dimly through the shadows and dark solitudes they wended, through the void domiciles of Dis, the bodiless regions. Just as, through fitful moonbeams, under the moon's thin light a path lies in a forest, when Jove has palled the sky with gloom, and the night's blackness has bled the world of colour. See, at the very porch and entranceway to Orcus, grief and ever-haunting anxiety make their bed. Here dwell pallid diseases, here morose old age, with fear, ill-prompting hunger, and squalid indigence, shapes horrible to look at, death and agony. Sleep, too, which is the cousin of death, and guilty joys, and there, against the threshold, war, the bringer of death. Here are the iron cells of the Furies, and lunatic strife, whose viperine hair is caught up with a headband soaked in blood. In the open, a huge dark elm tree spreads wide its immemorial branches like arms, whereon, according to old wives' tales, roost the unsolid dreams, clinging everywhere under its foliage. Besides, many varieties of monsters can be found stabled here at the doors, centaurs and freakish scyllas, Briareus with his hundred hands, the Lernaean hydra that hisses terribly, and the flame-throwing chimera, gorgons and harpies, and the ghost of three-bodied Geryon. Now did Aeneas shake with a spasm of fear, and drawing his sword, offered its edge against the creature's onset. Had not his learned guide assured him they were but incorporeal existences floating there, forms with no substance behind them, he'd have attacked them, and wildly winnowed with steel mere shadows. From here is the road that leads to the dismal waters of Acheron. Here a whirlpool boils with mud and immense swirlings of water, spouting up all the slimy sand of Cocytus. A dreadful ferryman looks after the river crossing, Charon. Appallingly filthy he is, with a bush of unkempt white beard upon his chin, with eyes like jets of fire, and a dirty cloak draggles down, knotted about his shoulders. He poles the boat, he looks after the sails, he is all the crew of that rust-coloured wherry which takes the dead across. An ancient now, but a god's old age is green and sappy. This way came fast, and streaming up to the bank the whole throng. Matrons and men were there, and there were great heart heroes finished with earthly life, boys and unmarried maidens, young men laid on the pyre before their parents' eyes. Multitudinous as the leaves that fall in a forest at the first frost of autumn, or the birds that out of the deep sea fly to land in migrant flocks, when the cold of the year has sent them overseas in search of a warmer climate. So they all stood, each begging to be ferried across first, their hands stretched out in longing for the shore beyond the river. But the surly ferryman embarks now this, now that group, while others he keeps away at a distance from the shingle. Aeneas, being astonished and moved by the great stir, said, "Tell me, O Sibyl, what means this mustering at the river? What purpose have these souls? By what distinction are some turned back, while other souls sweep over the wan water?" To which the long-lived Sibyl uttered this brief reply. "O son of Anchises' loins, and true-born offspring of heaven, what you see is the mere of Cocytus, the Stygian marsh, by whose mystery even the gods, having sworn, are afraid to be forsworn. All this crowd you see are the helpless ones, the unburied. That ferryman is Charon. The ones he conveys have had burial. None may be taken across from bank to awesome bank of that harsh-voiced river until his bones are laid to rest. Otherwise, he must haunt this place for 100 years before he's allowed to revisit the longed-for stream at last. The son of Anchises paused and stood stock still, in deep meditation, pierced to the heart by pity for their hard fortune. He saw there, sorrowing because deprived of death's fulfilment, Leucaspis and Orontes, the commodore of the Lycian squadron, who had gone down, their ship being lost with all hands in a squall, sailing with him the stormy seas from Troy. And look! Yonder was roaming the helmsman, Palinurus, who, on their recent voyage, while watching the stars, had fallen from the afterdeck, thrown off the ship there in mid-passage. A somber form in the deep shadows, Aeneas barely recognized him, then accosted. "Which of the gods, Palinurus, snatched you away from us and made you drown in the mid-sea? Oh, tell me! For Apollo, whom never before had I found untruthful, did delude my mind with this one answer, foretelling that you would make your passage to Italy unharmed by the sea. Is it thus he fulfills a sacred promise?" Palinurus replied, "The oracle of Phoebus has not tricked you, my captain, son of Anchises, nor was I drowned by a god. It was an accident. I slipped, and the violent shock of my fall broke off the tiller to which I was holding firmly as helmsman and steering the ship. By the wild seas I swear that not on my own account was I frightened nearly so much as lest your ship, thus crippled, its helmsman overboard, lose steerage way and founder amid the mountainous waves." 3 stormy nights did the south wind furiously drive me along over the limitless waters. On the 4th day I just caught sight of Italy, being lifted high on a wave crest. Little by little I swam to the shore. I was all but safe when, as I clung to the rough edge cliff top, my fingers crooked and my soaking garments weighing me down, some barbarous natives attacked me with swords, in their ignorance thinking that I was a rich prize. Now the waves have me. The winds keep tossing me up on the shore again. So now, by the sweet light and breath of heaven above, I implore you, and by your father, by your hopes for growing Ascanius, redeem me from this doom, unconquered one. Please sprinkle dust on my corpse. You can do it, and quickly get back to Port Velia. Or else, if way there is, some way that your heavenly mother is showing you, not for sure without the assent of deity would you be going to cross the swampy Stygian stream, give poor Palinurus your hand. Take me with you across the water, so that at least I may rest in the quiet place, in death." Thus did the phantom speak, and the Sibyl began to speak thus: "This longing of yours, Palinurus, has carried you quite away. Shall you, unburied, view the Styx, the austere river of the infernal gods, or come to its bank unbidden? Give up this hope that the course of fate can be swerved by prayer, but hear and remember my words to console you in your hard fortune. I say that the neighbouring peoples, compelled by portents from heaven occurring in every township, shall expiate your death, shall give you burial, and offer the solemn dues to your grave, and the place shall keep the name of Palinurus for ever." Her sayings eased for a while the anguish of his sad heart. He forgot his cares in the joy of giving his name to a region. So they resumed their interrupted journey, and drew near the river. Now, when the ferryman from out on the Styx espied them threading the soundless wood and making fast for the bank, he hailed them, aggressively shouting at them before they could speak,
"Whoever you are that approaches my river, carrying a weapon, halt there! Keep your distance, and tell me why you are come. This is the land of ghosts, of sleep and somnolent night. The living are not permitted to use the Stygian ferry, Not with impunity did I take Hercules when he came upon this water, nor Theseus, nor Pirithous, though their stock was divine and their powers were irresistible. Hercules wished to drag off on a leash the watchdog of Hades, even from our monarch's throne, and dragged it away, trembling. The others essayed to kidnap our queen from her lord's bedchamber.
The priestess of Apollo answered him shortly, thus, "There is no such duplicity here, so set your mind at rest. These weapons offer no violence. The huge watchdog in his kennel may go on barking forever and scaring the bloodless dead. Proserpine keeps her uncle's house unthreatened in chastity. Trojan Aeneas, renowned for war and a duteous heart, comes down to meet his father in the shades of the underworld. If you are quite unmoved by the spectacle of such great faith, this you must recognize." And here she disclosed the golden bough which was hid in her robe. His angry mood calms down. No more is said. Charon is struck with awe to see after so long that magic gift, the bough fate-given. He turns his somber boat and poles it towards the bank. Then, displacing the souls who were seated along its benches and clearing the gangways to make room for the big frame of Aeneas, he takes him on board. The ramshackle craft creaked under his weight and let in through its seams great swashes of muddy water. At last, getting the Sibyl and the hero safe across, he landed them amidst wan reeds on a dreary mudflat. Huge Cerberus, monstrously couched in a cave confronting them, made the whole region echo with his three-throated barking. The Sibyl, seeing the snakes bristling upon his neck now, threw him for bait a cake of honey and wheat infused with sedative drugs. The creature, crazy with hunger, opened its three mouths, gobbled the bait. Then its huge body relaxed and lay sprawled out on the ground the whole length of its cave kennel. Aeneas, passing its entrance, the watchdog neutralized, strode rapidly from the bank of that river of no return. At once were voices heard, a sound of mewling and wailing, ghosts of infants sobbing there at the threshold, infants from whom a dark day stole their share of delicious life, snatched them away from the breast, gave them sour death to drink. Next to them were those condemned to death on a false charge, yet every place is duly allotted and judgment is given. Minos, as president, summons a jury of the dead. He hears every charge, examines the record of each. He shakes the urn. Next again are located the sorrowful ones who killed themselves, throwing their lives away, not driven by guilt, but because they loathed living. How they would like to be in the world above now, enduring poverty and hard trials. God's law forbids. That unlovely fen with its glooming water corrals them there. The nine rings of Styx corral them in. Not far from here can be seen, extending in all directions, the Vale of Mourning, such is the name it bears, a region where those consumed by the wasting torments of merciless love haunt the sequestered alleys and myrtle groves that give them cover. Death itself cannot cure them of love's disease. Here Aeneas descried Phaedra and Procris, sad Eriphyle showing the wounds her heartless son once dealt her, Evadne and Pasiphae. With them goes Laodamia. Here too is Cineas, once a young man, but next a woman, and now changed back by fate to his original sex. Amongst them, with her death wound still bleeding, through the deep wood was straying Phoenician Dido. Now, when the Trojan leader found himself near her, and knew that the form he glimpsed through the shadows was hers, as early in the month one sees, or imagines he sees, through a rack of cloud the new moon rising and glimmering, he shed some tears, and addressed her in tender, loving tones. "Poor, unhappy Dido. So the message was true that came to me, saying you'd put an end to your life with the sword, and were dead? O God, was it death I brought you then? I swear by the stars, by the powers above, by whatever is sacred in the underworld, it was not of my own will, Dido, I left your land. Heaven's commands, which now force me to traverse the shades, this sour and derelict region, this pit of darkness, drove me imperiously from your side. I did not, could not, imagine my going would ever bring such terrible agony on you. Don't move away. Oh, let me see you a little longer, to fly from me, when this is the last word fate allows us. Thus did Aeneas speak, trying to soften the wild-eyed, passionate-hearted ghost, and brought the tears to his own eyes. She would not turn to him. She kept her gaze on the ground, and her countenance remained as stubborn to his appeal as if it were carved from recalcitrant flint or a crag of marble. At last she flung away, hating him still, and vanished into the shadowy wood where her first husband, Sychaeus, understands her unhappiness, and gives her an equal love. None the less did Aeneas, hard hit by her piteous fate, weep after her from afar as she went, with tears of compassion. Then he passed on the appointed way. They came to the last part of Limbo, the place set apart for men famous in war. Here Tydeus met him. Here that warrior of high renown, Parthenopaeus, here the pale spectre of Adrastus. Then those for whom lamentation had risen on earth, the fallen fighters of Troy. Aeneas groaned aloud when he saw those long ranks of death. Glaucus, Medon, Thersilochus, the three sons of Antenor, Polyphetes, the priest of Ceres, Idaeus, still with the arms he bore. The chariot he drove once. To right and left, the spirits press thickly around Aeneas. Not enough just to have seen him once. They want to detain him, to pace along beside him, and find out why he has come there. But the Greek generals and the regiments of Agamemnon, when they beheld his armour glinting through the gloom, were seized with fear and trembling. Some turned tail, even as in the old days they had run for their ships. Some uttered a wraith of a war cry. They tried to shout, but their wide mouths only whimpered. Just then Aeneas caught sight of Deiphobus, his whole body a mass of wounds, most horribly mangled about the face and both the hands, head mutilated, with ears torn off, and the nose lopped, a barbarous disfigurement. The moment he'd recognized that shrinking creature who covered his ghastly wounds, Aeneas burst out in familiar tones, "Deiphobus, great fighter, descended from high-born Teucer, who was it chose to inflict such atrocious punishment on you? Who could go to such lengths against you? On Troy's last night I heard a rumour that, worn out with killing and killing Greeks, you had sunk down on a huge indiscriminate heap of dead bodies. Then myself I erected by the Rhaetian shore a cenotaph for you, and thrice invoked your spirit aloud. Your name and a trophy mark the spot. Yourself I could not find to inter in your native soil before I departed." The son of Priam replied, "Dear friend, you neglected nothing. All that was needed you've done for Deiphobus and his shade. My destiny and the destructive nature of that Lycaean woman brought me to this. It was she who gave me these souvenirs. You remember how we spent that last night in rejoicings, in a fool's paradise? Too well, no doubt, you remember it. When the horse of doom had cleared at a bound the battlements of Troy, bearing an armed detachment within its belly, that woman faked a dance, led the Trojan women around, yelling in bacchanal orgy, under cover of which herself, with a blazing torch in her hand, signalled the Greeks from our citadel. I, worn out by our ordeals, and leaden with sleep, was lying in my unlucky bedroom under a coverlet of deep, delicious rest, very like the peace of death. Meantime, that nonpareil wife of mine removed all the arms from our house, yes, even my trusty sword from beneath my pillow. then called Menelaus inside, opened the door to him, hoping, vile thing, to make a wonderful present of me to her lover, and thus erase the stigma of her old wicked doings. No more of this. They burst into the bedroom. Ulysses was with them, promoter and compeer of crimes. Ye gods, may such deeds recoil on the Greeks, if my prayer for revenge is made with a clear conscience. But tell me now, in turn, what chance has brought you here alive? Were you compelled by your wanderings on the ocean, or a command from heaven? Or what fate irks you, that you should enter this joyless, sunless abode, these vague, vexed regions? So they conversed, till Aurora, driving her rosy chariot, had passed the midway point of the sky in her flying course. And indeed they might have used up all the allotted time thus, had not his guide, the Sibyl, spoken a few words of warning. Night comes apace, Aeneas, yet we spend the hours in grieving. Here is the spot where the way forks, going in two directions. The right hand leads beneath the battlements of great Dis, and is our route to Elysium. The left hand takes the wicked to Tartarus, their own place, and punishment condign. Deiphobus said, Great Sibyl, do not be angry with me. I will leave you, return to the shades, and make their number complete. Fare on, Aeneas, our pride, and with better luck than mine. Thus he spoke, and speaking, turned on his heel and went. Aeneas looked back on a sudden. He saw to his left a cliff overhanging a spread of battlements, a threefold wall about them, girdled too by a swift-running stream, a flaming torrent, hell's river of fire, whose current rolls clashing rocks along. In front, an enormous portal, the doorposts, columns of adamant, so strong that no mortal violence nor even the heaven-dwellers could broach it. An iron tower stands sheer and soaring above it, whereon Tisiphone sits, wrapped in a blood-stained robe, sleeplessly, day-long, night-long, guarding the forecourt there. From within can be heard the sounds of groaning and brutal lashing, sounds of clanking iron, of chains being dragged along. Scared by the din, Aeneas halted. He could not move. What kinds of criminals are these? Speak, lady. What punishments afflict them, that such agonized sounds rise up from there? Then the Sibyl began, O famous lord of the Trojans, no righteous soul may tread that threshold of the damned. But when Hecate appointed me to the Avernian grove, she instructed me in heaven's punishments, showed me all. Here Rhadamanthus rules, and most severe his rule is, trying and chastising wrongdoers, forcing confessions from any who, on earth, went gleefully undetected, but uselessly, since they have only postponed till death their atonement. At once Tisiphone, the avenger, scourge in hand, pounces upon the guilty, lashing them, threatening them with the angry snakes in her left hand, and calls up her bloodthirsty sisters. Then, at last, the hinges screech, the infernal gates grind open. Do you see that sentry, who she is, posted over the forecourt, the shape that guards the threshold? Within, there dwells a thing more fierce, the 50-headed Hydra, with all its black throats agape. Then Tartarus goes sheer down under the shades, an abyss double in depth for height that Olympus stands above a man gazing skyward. Here, Earth's primeval offspring, the breed of Titans, who were hurled down by Jove's lightning, writhe in the bottomless pit. Here have I seen the twin sons of Aloeus, the gigantic creatures who sought to pull down heaven itself with their own bare hands and to unseat Jove from his throne above. Salmoneus, too, have I seen, undergoing the rigorous sentence imposed when he mimicked the thunder and lightning of Jove Almighty, drawn by a four-horse team and shaking a lighted torch, he would go through Greece exulting, even through the middle of Elis City, claiming the homage due to the gods alone. Madman, to copy the nonpareil lightning, the thunderstorm, with a rumble of bronze wheels and a clatter of hard-hoofed horses. But the Father Almighty, among his serried storm clouds, launched a weapon. No torches, no smoky light of farthing dips was his, and hurled the blasphemer down with the wind of its passage. Titius, too, the nursling of earth who mothers all, was to be seen. His body pegged out over a full 9 acres, a huge vulture with hooked beak gnawing forever his inexhaustible liver, the guts that are rich in torment, pecking away for its food, burrowing deep through the body it lives in, and giving no rest to the always replenished vitals. Need I mention the Lapithi, Ixion, or Pirithous? Over them, always about to fall, and looking as if it were falling, a black crag hangs. Banqueting couches gleam with golden legs, raised high, and feasts of regal opulence are set before damned eyes. But the chief of the Furies, reclining nearby, forbids them to stretch out their hands for the food. She leaps up, menacing them with her lifted torch, and shouts like thunder. Here are those who in life hated their own brothers, or struck their parents, those who entangled their dependents in fraudulent dealing, and those who sat tight on the wealth they had won, setting none aside for their own kin. Most numerous of all are these. Then such as were killed for adultery, took part in militant treason, men who made bold to break faith with their masters, all such await punishment, mewed up here. And seek not to know what punishment, what kind of destined torment awaits each one in the pit. Some have to roll huge rocks, some whirl round, spread-eagled on spokes of wheels. The tragic Theseus sits, condemned to spend eternity in that chair. The poor wretch, Phlegyas, admonishes all, crying out through the murk in solemn avowal, "Be warned by me! Learn justice, and not to belittle the gods!" One sold his country for gold, putting her under the yoke of dictatorship, and corruptly made and unmade her laws. One entered the bed of his daughter, forced an unholy mating. All dared some abominable thing, and what they dared, they did. No, not if I had 100 tongues, 100 mouths and a voice of iron, could I describe all the shapes of wickedness, catalogue all the retributions inflicted here. Thus spoke the long-lived priestess of Phoebus, then added this, "But come, resume your journey, finish the task in hand. Let us go quickly on. I can see the bastions, forged in the Cyclops' furnaces, and the arch of the gateway yonder, where we are bidden to put down your passport, the golden bough." She had spoken. Side by side they went the twilight way, rapidly covering the space between, and approached the gateway. Aeneas stopped at the entrance, sprinkled himself with holy water, and placed the bough right at the doorway there. Now this was done at last, and Proserpine had her offering, they went on into the happy place, the green and genial glades where the fortunate live, the home of the blessed spirits. What largesse of bright air, clothing the vales in dazzling light, is here? This land has a sun and stars of its own. Some exercise upon the grassy playing fields, or wrestle on the yellow sands in rivalry of sport. Some foot the rhythmic dances and chant poems aloud. Orpheus, the Thracian bard, is there in his long robe, to accompany their measures upon the 7-stringed lyre which he plucks, now with his fingers, now with an ivory plectrum. Here is the ancient line of Teucer, a breed most handsome, great-hearted heroes born in the happier days of old, Elis, Assaracus, and Dardanus, founder of Troy. From afar, Aeneas marvelled at the arms, the phantom chariots. Spears stood fixed in the ground. Everywhere over the plain grazed the unharnessed horses. The pleasure those heroes had felt when alive in their arms and chariots, the care they had taken to pasture their sleek horses, all was the same beyond the tomb. Aeneas noticed others to left and right on the greensward, feasting and singing a jovial paean in unison amidst a fragrant grove of bay trees, whence the river Eridanus springs, to roll grandly through the woods of the world above. Here were assembled those who had suffered wounds in defence of their country, those who had lived pure lives as priests, and poets who had not disgraced Apollo, poets of true integrity, men who civilized life by the skills they discovered, and men whose kindness to other people has kept their memory green. All these, upon their temples, wore headbands white as snow. Now the Sibyl addressed the company dotted about there, and specially Musaeus, for round him a large group gazing up at him as he towered head and shoulders above them. "Tell me, you blessed spirits, and you, most honoured poet, whereabouts can we find Anchises? We have come here, crossing the great rivers of the underworld, to see him." So did Musaeus make reply with these few words. "None of us has a fixed abode. We dwell in shady groves, we make our beds on river banks, reside in water-sweet meadows. But if your heart's desire is such, then climb this rise, and I'll set your feet on an easy path." He spoke, and leading the way, showed them the luminous plains extending below them. Now they went down from the uplands. Deep in a green valley stood Father Anchises, surveying the spirits there confined before they went up to the light of the world above. He was musing seriously, and reviewing his folk's full tally, it happened, the line of his loved children, their destinies and fortunes, their characters and their deeds. Now, when he saw Aeneas coming in his direction over the grass, he stretched out both hands, all eagerness, and tears poured down his cheeks, and the words were tumbling out. "So you have come at last. The love that your father relied on has won through the hard journey? And I may gaze, my son, upon your face, and exchange the old homely talk with you? Thus, indeed, I surmised it would be, believed it must happen, counting the days till you came. I was not deceived in my hopes, then. Over what lands, what wide, wide seas you have made your journey, what dangers have beset you, and now you are here with me. How I dreaded lest you should come to some harm at Carthage." Aeneas replied, "Your image it was, your troubled phantom that often rising before me has brought me to this place. Our ships are riding at anchor in the Tyrrhene Sea. Oh, let me take your hand and embrace you, father. Let me. Withdraw not." Even as he spoke, his cheeks grew wet with a flood of tears. 3 times he tried to put his arms round his father's neck. 3 times the phantom slipped his vain embrace. It was like grasping a wisp of wind or the wings of a fleeting dream. Now did Aeneas descry, deep in a valley retiring, a wood, a secluded copse whose branches soughed in the wind, and Lethe River drifting past the tranquil places. Hereabouts were flitting a multitude without number. Just as, amid the meadows on a fine summer day, the bees alight on flowers of every hue, and brim the shining lilies, and all the lea is humming with them. Aeneas, moved by the sudden sight, asked in his ignorance what it might mean. What was that river over there, and all that crowd of people swarming along its banks? Then his father, Anchises, said, "They are souls who are destined for reincarnation. And now, at Lethe's stream, they are drinking the waters that quench man's troubles, the deep draught of oblivion. Long, long have I wanted to tell you of these, and reveal them before your eyes, to count them over, the seed of my seed, that you might the more rejoice with me in the finding of Italy." "But, father," Must it be deemed that some souls ascend from here to our earthly scene? Re-enter our dull corporeal existence? Why ever should so perverse a craving for earth possess them?
I will tell you, my son, certainly. I will not keep you in doubt, answered Anchises,
and then enlarged on each point successively. First, you must know that the heavens, the earth, the watery plains of the sea, the moon's bright globe, the sun and the stars are all sustained by a spirit within. For immanent mind, flowing through all its parts and leavening its mass, makes the universe work. This union produced mankind, the beasts, the birds of the air, and the strange creatures that live under the sea's smooth face. The life force of those seeds is fire, their source celestial, but they are deadened and dimmed by the sinful bodies they live in. The flesh that is laden with death, the anatomy of clay. Whence these souls of ours feel fear, desire, grief, joy, but encased in their blind dark prison, discern not the heaven light above. Yes, not even when the last flicker of life has left us, does evil, or the ills that flesh is heir to, quite relinquish our souls. It must be that many a taint grows deeply, mysteriously grained in their being from long contact with the body. Therefore the dead are disciplined in purgatory and pay the penalty of old evil. Some hang, stretched to the blast of vacuum winds. For others, the stain of sin is washed away in a vast whirlpool or cauterized with fire. Each of us finds in the next world his own level. A few of us are later released to wander at will through broad Elysium, the happy fields, until, in the fullness of time, the ages have purged that ingrown stain, and nothing is left but pure ethereal sentience and the spirit's essential flame. All these souls, when they have finished their thousand-year cycle, God sends for, and they come in crowds to the river of Lethe, so that, you see, with memory washed out, they may revisit the earth above and begin to wish to be born again. When Anchises had finished, he drew his son and the Sibyl into the thick of the murmuring concourse assembled there, and took his stand on an eminence from which he could scan the long files over against him, and mark the features of those who passed. Listen, for I will show you your destiny, setting forth the fame that from now shall attend the seed of Dardanus, the posterity that awaits you from an Italian marriage, illustrious souls, one day to inherit our Trojan name. That young man there, do you see him, who leans on an untipped spear, has been allotted the next passage to life, and first of all these will ascend to earth, with Italian blood in his veins. He is Silvius, an Alban name, and destined to be your last child, the child of your late old age, by a wife, Lavinia, who shall bear him in sylvan surroundings, a king and the father of kings, through whom our lineage shall rule in Alba Longa. Next to him stands Procas, a glory to the Trojan line, then Capys and Numitor, and one who'll revive your own name, Silvius Aeneas, outstanding alike for moral rectitude and prowess in war, if ever he comes to the Alban throne. What fine young men they are! Look at their stalwart bearing, the oak leaves that shade their brows, decorations for saving life. These shall be found your nomentum, Gabii, and Fidani. These shall rear on the hills Colatia's citadel, Pometii, and the fort of Ennuus, Bola, and Cora. All nameless sites at present, but then they shall have these names. Further, a child of Mars shall go to join his grandsire, Romulus, born of the stock of Assaracus by his mother, Elia. Look at the twin plumes upon his helmet's crest, Mars' cognizance, which marks him out for the world of Earth. His are the auguries, my son, whereby great Rome shall rule to the ends of the earth, shall aspire to the highest achievement, shall ring the seven hills with a wall to make one city, blessed in her breed of men. As Cybele, wearing her turreted crown, is charioted round the Phrygian cities, proud of her brood of gods, embracing 100 of her children's children, heaven-dwellers all tenants of the realm above. Now, bend your gaze this way. Look at that people there. They are your Romans. Caesar is there, and all Ascanius' posterity, who shall pass beneath the arch of day. And here is the man, the promised one you know of, Caesar Augustus, son of a god, destined to rule where Saturn ruled of old, in Latium, and there bring back the age of gold. His empire shall expand past Garamantes and Indians to a land beyond the zodiac and the sun's yearly path, where Atlas the sky-bearer pivots the wheeling heavens, embossed with fiery stars on his shoulder. Even now, the Caspian realm, the Crimean country, tremble at oracles of the gods predicting his advent, and the seven mouths of the Nile are in a sweat of fear. Not even Hercules roved so far and wide over earth, although he shot the bronze-footed deer, brought peace to the woods of Erymanthus, subdued Lerna with the terror of his bow, nor Bacchus, triumphantly driving his team with vines for reins, his team of tigers down from Mount Nysa, travelled so far. Do we still hesitate, then, to enlarge our courage by action, shrink from occupying the territory of Ausonia? Who is that in the distance, bearing the hallows, crowned with a wreath of olive? I recognize, grey hair and hoary chin, that Roman king who, called to high power from humble Cures, a town in a poor area, shall found our system of law, and thus refound our city. The successor of Numa, destined to shake our land out of its indolence, stirring men up to fight who have grown unadventurous and lost the habit of victory, is Tullus. After him shall reign the too boastful Ancus, already overfond of the breath of popular favour. Would you see the Tarquin kings, and, arrogant as they, Brutus, the Avenger, with the symbols of civic freedom he won back? He shall be first to receive consular rank and its power of life and death. When his sons awake the dormant conflict, their father, a tragic figure, shall call them to pay the extreme penalty for fair freedom's sake. However posterity look on that deed, patriotism shall prevail and love of honour. See over there the Decii, the Drusi, Torquatus with merciless axe, Camillus with the standards he recovered. See those twin souls, resplendent in duplicate armour? Now they're of one mind, and shall be as long as the underworld holds them. But oh, if ever they reach the world above, what warfare, what battles and what carnage will they create between them? Caesar, descending from Alpine strongholds, the fort of Monicus, his son-in-law Pompey, lined up with an eastern army against him. Lads, do not harden yourselves to face such terrible wars. Turn not your country's hand against your country's heart. You be the first to renounce it, my son of heavenly lineage. You be the first to bury the hatchet. That one shall ride in triumph to the lofty capital, the conqueror of Corinth, renowned for the Greeks he has slain. That one shall wipe out Argos and Agamemnon's Mycenae, destroying an heir of Aeacus, the seed of warrior Achilles, avenging his Trojan sires and the sacrilege done to Minerva. Who could leave unnoticed the glorious Cato, Cossus, the family of the Gracchi, the two Scipios, thunderbolts in war and death to Libya, Fabricius, who had plenty in poverty, Serenus, sowing his furrowed fields, Fabii, where do you lead my lagging steps? Oh, Fabius, the greatest, you the preserver of Rome by delaying tactics. Let others fashion from bronze more lifelike, breathing images, for so they shall, and evoke living faces from marble. Others excel as orators. Others track with their instruments the planets circling in heaven and predict when stars will appear. But, Romans, never forget that government is your medium. Be this your art, to practice men in the habit of peace.